Now tonight we're going to do something a little different. Instead of giving you principles, as I have been sort of just laying them out for you, tonight I'm going to let you gather your own principles from what we do. And I'm just going to kind of let you in on a counseling session. I'll sort of conduct it, taking all the parts. And more than that, I'll step out of it now and then to make a few comments about these characters who are in it. And as we go along, maybe you can, on your own, write down the principles without me doing too much of that kind of effort for you. So I'll warn you ahead of time, that's how we're going to proceed. And it'll be necessary for you to do a little extra work on your own. Don't get caught up in the dialogue and the pathos and all that kind of stuff and forget to write down principles. Now, we're talking about marriage counseling tonight. And in order to talk about marriage counseling, one of the areas of counseling that you will find yourself involved in perhaps most frequently of all, I would like to begin by posing a situation that probably is as serious as any that you can find. And if you get the principles for handling this kind of situation, you can probably generalize it to the less difficult ones. Here I am, sitting in my counseling office, and in come a husband and a wife. And they've decided, even though they're Christians, and even though they have no biblical reason to do so, they've decided to get a divorce. Both of their minds are made up. They're not really here to get any help. That's one of the things that makes this tougher. And because they're not here to get any help, they come really in order to demonstrate that no help can be given. That makes it tough too. You see, they come in order to stump the counselor. And they think that if they can successfully play the game, stump the counselor, that this may in some way or other relieve the gnawing, guilty, sore conscience that they have down inside, resulting from their inner decision to commit sin. So they come. And the husband begins by telling us how terrible it's been over the last 15 years of marriage. He sketches a picture that is horrendous. And he's only scratched the surface. He didn't have to invent anything. He simply told the truth about the high spots. And his wife tells a similar story, equally as horrendous, equally as true. And at the conclusion of what he says, the husband ends with words something like this. So you see, I just don't love her. I loathe her. There isn't a drop of love left in me for her anymore. And she at the conclusion of her story says, so, you see, there's nothing to build our marriage on. I just don't feel a thing for him anymore. Nothing there. They both settle back, arms folded. Now what's he going to say? What can he say if there's nothing to build a marriage on? If there's no feeling left except, in the one case, loathing, no love, you know, what's he going to be able to say? Well, they think all he can say is, well, I guess if things are that bad, if your marriage has gone that far, I guess there's only one thing you could do. In your case, God will make an exception, and you're going to have to get a divorce. Here's the imprimatur of the Church of Jesus Christ, nihil obstat, go ahead, nothing hinders. So, they come to this place, they settle back. And I say to them, well, I guess if things are that bad, there's only one thing you can do. I think, ah, here it comes. I guess there's only one thing you can do. You're going to have to learn how to love each other. They look at me. They look at each other. And they look at me. And almost simultaneously they say, learn to love? What in the world do you mean by learning to love? I never heard anybody talk about learning to love. I say, yeah. You're going to have to learn to love each other. And they just kind of sit there. Learn to love. How can you learn to love? He might say, or she. I say, well, you see, the Bible looks at love as something that God commands. And so if it can be commanded, it can be done. And you can learn to do whatever God commands you to do if you're His child. And I point out to them that the Bible continually talks about love in terms of commandments. For example, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, body, soul, and strength. That's a command. And in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives. That's a command. Well, fellow says, now wait a minute. How can I love her if I loathe her? If I've got all these feelings down inside, negative feelings to her, how can I have positive feelings toward her? And I say to him, you can get positive feelings toward her if you learn to love her. But he says, that's a contradiction. I've got to have positive feelings in order to love her. I say, oh, no, you don't. I don't? You don't. I can love her even though I loathe her? Yes. I can love her when I loathe her? Yes. Well, that's sure a contradiction to me. Would you clear that up? Delighted to. Of course, all of you could clear it up readily too. You see, loathing is a feeling, but loving isn't primarily a feeling. Loving is not a feeling first. There is a feeling that grows out of love, that issues from it. But one of the big problems we have on our American scene is that we believe that love is first and foremost and in essence a feeling. And it isn't. And that's why we've got so many marriages like yours. You see, if love, as the American cinema has portrayed it, is kind of a itch down inside somewhere around your heart that you can't get your hand in deep enough to scratch, and so you've got to give in to it. If that's what love is, then we're all sunk because it just kind of smacks us beside the side of the head and we're suddenly involved in it and we had nothing to do with it. And if it drifts away just as suddenly or just as gradually as it may have come, we have nothing to do with that either. And so we have to be kind of slaves to this love. And indeed, you hear many songs about people acting like slaves toward love. But love isn't like that. Love is a volitional thing in the Scriptures. Love is something that can be commanded, that you can do even when you don't feel like doing it, even when you feel like doing the opposite from it. Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 she says. I don't believe that. If I believe that I could loathe somebody and love somebody at the same time, I believe I'd be a hypocrite for saying that I love them when I loathe them. God didn't want me to be a hypocrite. That's a pretty good answer, isn't it? No. Why not? Because, again, you see, you've got a wrong view of hypocrisy. Just like you have a feeling-oriented view of love, you have a feeling-oriented view of hypocrisy. You live in this feeling-oriented society in which we are in, about which we've been talking in these lectures last night and this morning. And you see, a feeling-oriented view of hypocrisy is a very wrong and unbiblical view of hypocrisy. People today, when they talk about hypocrisy, say, if I don't feel like doing something and I do it, I'm a hypocrite. But that isn't the way the Bible talks. You see, If that were true, the very first thing that I did this morning, ma'am, I would have been a hypocrite. I got up. I didn't feel like getting up. I loathe to get up. I never feel like getting up. I hate to get up. I feel like taking the alarm clock and throwing it right straight through the window, pulling the covers over my head and forgetting the world and everything in it, and going back to sleep. That's how I feel every morning, but I get up anyway. Now, that doesn't make me a hypocrite, does it? Of course it doesn't. To act against my feelings in accordance with my responsibilities does not make me a hypocrite. It simply makes me a responsible person. That's all. What would make me a hypocrite? If I came here tonight and somehow I represented by the way that I acted, or I said something to you that would lead you to believe that I enjoyed getting up in the morning, if I put on the false face of hypocrisy and misled you about my real feelings in the morning, then I'd be a hypocrite. But I told you that all my feelings in my body say, don't do it. So I'm not a hypocrite when I do it against my feelings. I'm just responsible. And the first thing I have to do every morning, ma'am, is the thing I have to do all through life, all day long. There are lots of things in life that I don't want to do, that I don't feel like doing, that I would much rather do something else than. But I have to do them anyway, in spite of my feelings. You know, the interesting thing about it is that when I do what God has made me responsible to do, suddenly my feelings begin to change. When I get up in the morning, I don't feel like it, and I kind of slink around a little bit until I get some toothpaste and get it on my brush and do a little scrubbing, and my mouth tastes a little better, less iron flavoring in it, or around here, iodine, I think they put in the water. Have you tasted that taste in the water? It's extraordinary. Best thing I can gather is that it's iodine. Even the tea and the coffee doesn't disguise it. It just cuts right through all of that flavor and demands attention. But at any rate, you tell me if I'm wrong about the substance, but it tastes just like iodine, pure, unadulterated iodine, straight into the water. One of the best purifiers ever going, but a little overdone. At any rate, whatever I was talking about, the point here is that when I do what I have to do, like brushing my teeth in the morning, I begin to feel a little better. And especially when I get downstairs and get a little something in my stomach, begin to look at the sun shining or the rain falling, as the case may be, whichever is needed, and feel that this world isn't quite so bad as it looked when I was in bed, my feelings begin to change, you see. And I'm glad I got. On the other hand, if I stay in bed and the phone rings and everybody says, hey, where are you? You're to be down here to work doing X, Y, or Z. Then I begin to feel lousy, though for the moment, while I turned over and rolled over in bed, I felt great. So the consequences of my behavior kind of change my feelings rather rapidly. Even though for the moment, it feels better to go on obeying those feelings. And so, ma'am, you see, it doesn't make you a hypocrite to act against your feelings. When you're acting according to what God requires of you, you're simply acting as a responsible Christian. That's not a hypocrite. And, surprisingly, your feelings are going to change. You can begin to love somebody even when you feel loathing for that person. And if you continue to love him or her long enough, the loathing will begin to change too. Well, I don't know about that. Well, let's just think about it a little bit more. What does the Bible say about loving? What is love? Let me tell you. Love is when you decide to please God by obeying His command to give to another whatever it is that God says you are required to give to that person. Love is giving to another what you have that person could use that God tells you to give, whether you feel like it or not. Listen, God to set the model of love. God so loved the world that he emoted all over it. No. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. He gave. Love began with giving with God. Now how about with us? It says in Ephesians 5:25, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. Galatians 2:20, the last part, he loved me and gave himself for me. You see, loving in the Bible quickly moves to its first large element, giving. And when we give, and give and give and give and give and give, and give enough and make enough investments as we give and give and give, there is a treasure that begins to build up in that person to whom we give. And where our treasure is, the Bible says, that's where our heart is also. Your heart will begin to change. Your interest, your concerns, your affections, everything that heart means, the whole inner person will begin to change its orientation towards that person when you invest enough of yourself, your time, your interest, your money, whatever it is that you're giving to that other person. If you give, 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 your whole attitude toward that person will begin to change because you will have a large investment, a treasure in that person in whom you have given. Well, maybe so, but where do we begin? Well, sir, we begin with you. With me? What do you mean with me? I thought that love was for women and children. Well, I know that's what our society has largely taught over the years. That love is kind of a gushy thing that has to do with pink-cheeked cherubs. And I could have said cherry-cheeked cherubs, if you prefer. Say it 6 times if you can. Pink-cheeked cherubs. And has to do with lace doilies and bows and arrows and little hearts and Valentine's Day. That's what a lot of people think love has to do with, but that isn't the biblical picture of love at all. Love in the Bible is first and foremost a very masculine thing and a very manly thing. Love in the Bible is something like this. Love is facing a terrible ordeal and sweating drops of blood over having to face it and yet going on to do it. Love is standing there with your hands lashed to a post while somebody takes a leather whip with 4 or 5 thongs on it, on which have been sewed little pieces of metal or bone, and then takes that whip and 39 times stripes it across your back until the flesh quivers and the blood trickles down over it. Love is taking a crown of thorns and pressing it down on somebody's head and standing there as that person and enduring it for somebody else, giving of your life that way for another person. Love is a very hard and firm and masculine thing in the Bible. It's not a silly sentimental gush. And so you see, sir, love begins with you. That's why in Ephesians 5 it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Sir, if there is no love in this family, indeed as you have testified, it is primarily your fault. My fault. Your fault. I never heard anybody say that before. That's precisely why the marriage is in the shape it's in. Do you know that in the New Testament, the wife is not once commanded to love her husband? Oh, I know. Maybe one of you here are thinking about Titus 2. Were you thinking about Titus 2? Forget it. Different word in the original. Here's how it ought to be translated. The only translation you can get away with on that word is the more mature women are to teach the younger women how to be affectionate to their husbands. That's a very important thing to teach, but that's not our subject tonight. It's a different word. It's not the word for love that's used throughout the Bible. It's the word for showing affection. So, I repeat my statement. Sir, not once in the New Testament is a wife commanded to love her husband. Doesn't mean she can't do it, you understand. But the reason why she isn't commanded to do so, and the reason why the husband continually, four times in this short passage, for example, is commanded to love his wife, is because he is primarily responsible to do so. That's his role. It is not the woman's role to initiate love, to maintain love, and to see that love grows in the family. That is the husband's role, first and foremost and finally. Nobody ever told me that. As I said, sir, that's one reason why the marriage is in the trouble that it's in right now. You see, this says, husbands, love your wife. Well, why us? Why the husbands? Why are we supposed to that? We're supposed to go out and do all the earning and everything else, and now we're also responsible for the love. Wait a minute. Listen, sir. Here's why you are responsible for this. You are responsible to love your wife as Christ loved the church because you are to represent in that marriage Jesus Christ as she represents the church. And you see, Jesus Christ didn't sit up in heaven waiting for the church to start loving him. And then come after the church became so loving toward him and said, well, I've got to return love to people who love me that much. That isn't the picture, is it?
Well, no.
What did he do? He determined to set his love on certain people whom he was going to call to be his own and be his church, and he was going to love them dearly. Love them so much he would die for them. Now, they weren't lovable. They weren't lovely. They weren't loving. Indeed, the Bible calls them sinners. While they were sinners, he loved them. It goes further than that. It says, while they were enemies, he loved them and gave himself for them. Enemies. Now, an enemy in the Bible, you've got to understand, an enemy is not just somebody who doesn't like you. An enemy in the Bible is clearly outlined as to what an enemy is. Go through the Psalms sometime. I haven't even time to tell you all that David says about what his enemies did to him, but just look at what David, just take the Psalms of David, see what David says his enemies were doing to him. Here you have him, for example, working all day long, building a beautiful trap, covering it over carefully so that when David comes walking along the road, he'll fall into the trap. Or you've got them staying up all night holding conferences, losing all kinds of sleep, getting themselves into hallucinations, perhaps over sleep loss, but spending all wasting all kinds of hours figuring out schemes in which they can get at David. An enemy is somebody who has made it his full-time occupation to make you miserable. That's the way I can define an enemy in the book of Psalms. An enemy is somebody who has just shot an arrow through your best new hat when he was aiming 6 inches lower. It's hard to love somebody like that. And yet Christ did it. And your wife may not be loving. She may not be lovely anymore. She may not be lovable. But you can love her. And you're commanded to love her. Whether you feel like it or not. Whether she's lovely, loving, or lovable or not. And you're to take the initiative in seeing that there's love in this home. If there's no more love in this home, as both of you have testified anymore, you're to take the initiative, sir, because you are to represent Jesus Christ in what you do in this family. And we read in 1 John, we love, the church loves, because he, Jesus Christ, first loved us. There it is. That, sir, is why the heat is on you today. Now, this says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. You're going to have to learn how to love this woman by giving to her. You're going to have to learn how to give to her so much that you'd be willing to give your life to her, for her if necessary. You're to love her as Christ loved the church. I can never love her the way Christ loved the church. Well, maybe not right away if that's your attitude, and maybe you don't want to start at that level. I certainly don't. All right, then. Let's consider this. The Bible says, love your neighbor. There's another command. She's the closest one you got. You live with her, you eat with her, you sleep with her, you share the TV, the newspaper with her, the same bed. I couldn't love her like I love my neighbor. All right, sir. If you don't want to start at that level, we'll drop to a lower level. The Bible commands, love your enemies. I don't care where you begin. You can start on any one of these levels, but you're going to learn to love her. You can learn to love her as a wife. You can learn to love her as a neighbor. You can learn to love her as an enemy. You can start any one of these places, but before we're through, you're going to learn to love her all three ways. How do you love an enemy? See, there's no way out. So let's start there. How do you love an enemy? Well, I don't know. I've said it was hard when he's just shot an arrow through your hat. Harder when it goes through your head, yeah. Sometimes impossible. How do you love an enemy? I don't know. Well, let me explain. Please do. All right? You don't start loving an enemy, and the Bible doesn't tell you to start loving an enemy, by trying to womp up some kind of a warm, benevolent feeling for your enemy. Standing around going, womp, womp. Womp, womp. Trying to change your feelings. You see, when you try to womp it up, you find out it won't womp. It doesn't work that way. So what do? Well, the Bible doesn't tell you to go womping. The Bible says, if your enemy hungers, give him something to eat. Give! If your enemy thirsts, give him something to drink. Give! We're right back to the same old point again. You begin loving an enemy by giving to an enemy whatever it is that enemy needs. You see? That's where you begin. If you had to womp up some kind of warm, benevolent feeling before you could give to your enemy, he'd die of malnutrition. Because you just can't produce feelings on command that way. Think you can? Want to try it? Everybody sit up straight. You're slouching. Get a deep breath. One, two, three. Everyone inhale. All right. One, two, three. Hate. Come on, hate. Total failure. You're laughing. Hate. See? There you go. Trying to womp up a hate and you start laughing. Just can't quite turn it on command like that, you see, that readily when you got an opposite feeling going. So, we're not talking about commanding people to turn off their feelings and turn on another feeling on command at a moment's notice, but we're talking about something you can do no matter how you feel. You can give an enemy a cup of cold water if you're gritting your teeth the whole time you're doing it. You can give it to them even when you don't feel like it, you see. All right. You got that point now.
Yeah, I'm afraid I've got it.
Well, okay. I'm supposed to do this thing, but I don't know where to begin. How do I start giving? Oh, I thought you'd never get around to asking. Let's get into that question a little bit. Let's turn to 1 Peter 3. Oh, yeah, let's turn to that. That's that one about the wives. No, sir. You misunderstand. I want to go to 3:7. 3:7, what's that? That's the next verse after he finishes talking to the wives. That's the one that talks to the husband. Oh. A lot of people forget that seventh verse because they get so excited about the first six, which are great verses, but the seventh is there too. Well, let's take a look at that seventh verse. You husbands, likewise, Live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker vessel, since she is a woman. Weaker vessel, you should know what you... Wait a minute, sir. Just wait a minute, please. I'll get to that in time. We'll get to that passage. It doesn't really say she's a weaker vessel. I'll get to it. But let's take things in order. All right, as long as you get to it. I will, I promise. Now it says, you husbands, likewise. What's the likewise have to do with? Well, very much like the same thing in verse 1, you wives, likewise. And of course, all that goes back to the second chapter, where we have again one of those unnatural chapter headings that breaks up the thought and the flow of the passage. Remember, none of the headings were inspired, none of them were in the original letters. They were all written by people whose horses stepped into potholes and they wrote them in at the wrong place. Remember that. The second chapter has to do with how Jesus suffered under difficult circumstances of persecution and suffered in a way that pleased God. Handled that persecution in a way that honored God. He did right in spite of all the problems that he had to face. Now he's telling the wives, who are wives of a disobedient husband, one who doesn't obey the word of God, how they can live under persecution that that husband may bring to them. And now he's telling the husbands how they can live under situations where their wives aren't very nice to live with either. And so you see, he's beginning to tell you what you can do regardless of what your wife does or doesn't do. Your responsibilities are yours just as hers are hers, regardless of what the other party does. What you do, sir, does not depend upon what she did. What she does not depend upon what you do, because God is the one who told you to do what you do, and God is the one who told her to do what she should do, and you're to do it before God, and you're to do it before God, not because the other person did or didn't do something. Well, let's get that clear from the beginning. Now it says, you husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way. How in the world am I ever going to understand a woman? Well, sir, that little cliche that you're using now, that you can't understand a woman, has been a very, very bad one. I want to take issue with that cliche. God says you are to understand a woman. And I know that all over American humor and all over the humor that you read, perhaps in other countries, you have this kind of an attitude, oh, you'll never understand a woman. And you probably have bought that kind of stuff because you've heard it so often and maybe you've said it so often. I want to tell you, this passage says it's false. A Christian here, a Christian husband, is commanded to understand a woman. Now, I didn't say, and this doesn't say that you are to understand more than one. That might be more than any man can do. But it does, it most certainly does require that you understand one woman, your wife. And she probably doesn't care whether you understand any others or not. So, sir, you're going to learn to understand this woman. This woman? Me? You. Now, literally in the Greek it says, husbands, live with your wives according to knowledge. According to knowledge. What do you know about your wife? Well, what do you mean, what I know about her? Well, what do you know about her? Do you know a lot about her or not? Well, I don't know. Well, what is she like? Everything I don't like. That's not concrete enough, sir. What sort of things does she really like? Well, I don't know. What sort of... aspirations does she have in life? How would I know? What are her goals in life?
Well, she never told me anything about goals.
Did you ever ask her?
Well, of course not. Why should I ask my wife about goals?
It's to do with sports, rugby or something. Well, sir, you don't know much about her, do you?
Well, I don't know.
That's what I said, you don't know. Yeah, I guess that's right. You're going to have to learn all you can about this woman. Well, how am I going to learn about her? Sir, what do you do? I'm a salesman. Are you a good one? Of course I am. Well, now, sir, I'm glad to hear you're a good salesman because I'd like you to verify something for me. As a salesman, what you do when you go to sell a new client that you've never met before is to just, of course, arrive on his doorstep, announce yourself to his secretary that you're here, whether she knows you or not, whether you have an appointment or not, whether you know much about the guy or not, and say, may I see your boss? Isn't that what you do as a good salesman? You don't know anything about selling, do you, preacher? Well, I don't know, but isn't that what you do? Of course not! Well, what do? Well, I go around and I talk to all the other guys who know this fellow, and I learn everything I can about him. Oh, my. Yeah, I see what you're talking about. You're saying that I research my clients or prospective clients a lot more thoroughly than I've researched my wife. Guess that's true. You mean I really got a researcher? Right. Really? Really. After all, what's a client? What's a client? Somebody you have for a little while or you don't get or you do have for a lifetime of business as long as you're in the business and so on. He's a little piece of your business or a big piece of your business or something. So what? You got a wife that God gave to you and you're to live with her in the most intimate of all possible relationships among two human beings. That's what he's required of you and that's the privilege he's given to you. That's the joy and the wonder of marriage. Somebody who can open her heart and tell you everything that's down inside and feel free to do so without knowing that you're not going to step on her heart with track shoes. And somebody to whom you can open your heart and your soul and tell your fears and your failures and your sorrows and your heartaches to. Somebody with whom you have become one, as Genesis says and as Paul says, and repeating it in this fifth chapter of Ephesians, to become one flesh. And the word flesh there doesn't refer merely to the sexual relation, but it means one person. You know, in Genesis, where the word flesh is used, it's used in equivalent as equivalent with the word person. Where in the flood, a few chapters later, he says, I'm going to bring a flood upon all flesh. He means, as we say in English, everybody. But when we say everybody, we don't mean everybody. We mean everybody. See the difference between everybody and everybody? We don't put the emphasis on the syllable body. We put the emphasis on the syllable every. And it makes a difference as to what you, how you use a word like everybody. Whereas everybody does have in the makeup of the word everybody, it doesn't really put the emphasis on the word body, but it simply means every person. And so when they said all flesh, they didn't mean all flesh, just the flesh, not the bones, so to speak. But they meant every person. The flood would come upon every person, just as we say everybody, every person. And so when he said, when God said, I will make the two of you one flesh, he meant I'll make you one person. You'll become so much a part of each other that whatever happens, as Paul says in quoting that passage in Ephesians 5, whatever happens to one really happens to the other. You can't hurt your wife without hurting yourself. You can't bless your wife without blessing yourself. Two of you are one person. You're so closely united to each other. That's what God has made two people in a marriage to be. So, you're going to have to learn what it means to love this woman, to give to this woman. And in order to learn how to please her, how to meet true needs in her life and true desires in her life and true joys in her life and how to bring the things to her that will be a blessing to her, You're going to have to know all you can about her, and that means you're going to have to research her. Now, one way to research somebody is by observation, for example. Observation. Observation. The next time you go to the department store with her and you notice it, ha, 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 go to the department store with me. He'd never been to the department store with me in his life. Now, madam, I'll get to you in a moment. Just relax. We'll get there eventually. Don't you go to the department store with her, sir? No. Well, it's about time you did if you want to observe her. Next time you go to the department store with her, notice when she passes by something and she picks it up and looks at it a little bit longer than the other thing she picked up. Puts it down again. You go on your way. And then on the way back, she picks it up once more, turns it over to see what's written on the bottom of that piece of china or whatever it is, and puts it down again. Put that one in your little book. She likes that. Observe her. Watch her during the day to see what her problems are at home. Even if you don't follow her around literally, which you might do it sometimes, you can at least kind of think through what she has to do in a day and follow her around in your mind to see what she's coping with in that family and in that situation and in that home that you've provided for her, with or without some of the things that she might need to do the job properly. I once knew a man in a counseling context who refused to get his wife a vacuum. There are rugs in every room in the house. It was a horrendous situation. I don't know how he ever expected her to do the job. He just didn't even think about it. What do you need a vacuum for? It's a waste of money, you know, and he had the money to buy it. Ridiculous. Well, now, most people aren't that bad, but maybe there are a lot of little things that you could do that could make her job a lot more pleasant and a lot more joyous, and certainly if you were to do those little things for her, it would be a thing that would please her. And you would understand that those things that you could do for her would be pleasing to her, and you could give such things to her. Observation is one way to begin to research her. Of course, another way is to interview her. Interview her? Of course, interview. When did you ever ask her what some of her goals or aspirations or fears or something else might be? Well, I guess I've never done that. But she wouldn't answer me. She will, because we're going to write down our homework assignment. And we're going to get this. Wouldn't you really, ma'am, like him to really want to know what's down deep inside of you and what you're thinking about? What you really care about? What you're really concerned about? Yes, I think I would. If he'd do it out of real concern. Not to laugh at me. Not to make fun of me. Not to argue with me. But to really know and really care and really do something about it, I would. And will you tell him if he asked you in the right way? If he really sits down to interview you, will you begin to tell him these things? I'd love to. I'd love to. You would? I would. Well, then you're going to. That's item one on the homework sheet. But there are many other things, sir, that you're going to have to discover through testing. That's the third way, testing. Observation. This is your research model. Observation, interviewing, and testing. How do I test? Well, I'm going to give you another assignment on your homework sheet this time. I'll write this down. And I'll give this all to you, so just listen now, but I'll give it in written form so you can't misunderstand it. Every day this week, I would like you to do one thing just to please your wife. One small thing. Excuse me, I should underline that word small. One small thing just to please your wife. Something you don't normally do or ordinarily do at all. Some small thing each day just to please your wife. I know, I'll buy her. Wait a minute, I haven't finished yet, sir. And it should be something that you do not purchase. Aww. No, this will take more creativity and give more of yourself if you have to think of something creatively to give to your wife each day just to please her. Now, I've said small thing because I once knew a man, not under my counseling, but I once knew a man who gave his wife a huge rug, a very expensive rug, which she loved because he gave it to her, but hated because of what it looked like. And she had a terrible conflict over that rug every time she walked in the room to look at it because it conflicted with everything else in the room. And she so loved the fact that her husband gave it to her, but she so hated the fact that he didn't have any better taste or at least any better understanding of her taste. So since, sir, you're only beginning to learn what it is that your wife loves, and this is an assignment to help test what it is that are her interests and her desires and so on, we're going to emphasize and underline this word small even more strongly. Make it a small thing so that a great investment of your time or self or money or anything else is not involved. So this week, one small thing each day that you've never done before just to please your wife, and you can't buy it. Well, that's a very interesting thing. You willing to do that? Yes, I think I am. I think I'd find out a lot that way. You may find out you don't do everything that you ought to do the right way, that you may not please her with everything you do. I once had a counselee who did this assignment, you know, and he gave his wife something that when she came in the next week, she was furious. And I said, "What's wrong?" She said, "You know what he gave me." I said, "No, not until you tell me." She said, "He gave me a freestanding hen's tooth holder." I said, "Oh, what? You heard me, a freestanding hen's tooth holder." "What on earth is a freestanding hen's tooth holder?" I asked her, and he's over here chuckling. She's angry as she can be. "What is a freestanding hen's tooth holder?" She said, "I don't know." I said, "Would you explain, sir? You created it." He said, "Well, you know, it's a little paper cone that I developed that sort of sat on at the bottom and came to a point. And the point was the holder part because, you see, hen's teeth, you know, the old expression, as scarce as hen's teeth, that means there aren't any such thing. And so since this is a point which couldn't hold them if there were, then there isn't any, you know." So I said, "Yeah, I understand." She said, "See?" I said, now you see, this was a good test because it pointed out a couple of things. First of all, pointed out that you did what pleased you, sir, rather than what pleased her. You're over here chuckling. She's furious. The assignment was to do what pleased her. But you didn't distinguish between the two. You see, what pleases you isn't necessarily what will please her, as you have found out through this assignment. On the other hand, ma'am, you shouldn't be angry over this fact. You should just simply say, "I'll give him A for effort. I'll flunk him on the final product." You ought to acknowledge, plainly and clearly, he made an effort. Now, it didn't succeed in many respects, but he made an effort. And you ought to encourage him if he makes an effort. And I want to see you encouraging him every time he does make some kind of an effort, even if the effort is unproductive. Now, after all, ma'am, after all, how would it be if you made a luscious lemon meringue pie for him and he acted the wrong way? For example, let's suppose that you had created a veritable masterpiece, stood that tall. Half lemon and half meringue. And that meringue had a golden brown edge to it, with those little clear beads setting up all along the edge. You know? Yeah.
And as you took your... Stop that, Jim. Jim, you're wrecking my description. And as you took your fork, it went through that meringue until it struck the lemon below and then gently bounced on the surface of the lemon. Ah, but the lemon was firm but yielding. Poor old Jim over there. And the fork continued on its journey without obstruction until finally it met that flaky crust below, which splintered under the impact. Now suppose your wife had created a masterpiece like that for you, and the taste was equal to the vision. And you took that pie and you put it in front of you. And you went, tickle-gum, 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 blah! Without so much as a word. Come on now. Relax, you're going to the... Are you quite through? Suppose that you did this without so much as even a thank you. Would you be likely to get another effort made in that direction? Hardly. But suppose instead, the next evening, or better still, 5 months after that, your wife, on entertaining a guest, had the wife in the kitchen with her, and you were in the living room with her husband, and she overheard you describing that lemon meringue pie just that way to that husband. And his wife heard you doing it too. Would you be likely to get another one? You better believe it. So, sir, ma'am, if he makes an effort, even an effort, encourage him. Thank him. Congratulate him for the effort while scoring zero for the content. Give him an honest test, an honest answer of whether you appreciated that particular thing or not, and tell him you did appreciate the effort. And things are going to happen. Okay, that's your assignment for this week, sir. Well, what about that business about a weaker vessel? You didn't give me a chance. I told you I was going to get to it. This says, you husbands, live with your wives according to knowledge as with a weaker vessel. How do you live with a weaker vessel? The answer to that? I suppose if I scratched my ear, you'd laugh. The answer to that is you live with a weaker vessel very carefully. Let's translate this in such a way that you'll understand what he's saying. Live with your wives as with a fragile vase. That's what he's saying. You don't take a fragile vase and say, let's see, where am I going to put it? Oh, here, clunk. Well, you take a fragile vase and you take it over like this and you set it down very carefully. That's how you're to live with your wife. As you would gently handle a fragile vase, you are to be a gentle man. In the literal sense of that word, a gentle man with your wife. Now, I know, sir,
certain men who treat their wives like you treat an old tin garbage can. You know how the garbage collector treats the garbage can? Where's our Australian lady? Is she here tonight? It's the rubbish man. Rubbish man, excuse me. All right, got to give you proper English here. Proper English. The garbage man comes along, and he spies a shiny new garbage can with the top fitting snugly on the top. Takes that garbage can, throws the top off, lets it fall where it may, and into that iron monster with its arms reached out like a Moloch idol, ready to compress the stuff back into the bowels of it. Into that iron monster, he takes this can and he takes it and he goes, clunk! And the can stops as it hits against this iron piece and the garbage keeps moving into the arms which compress it. Of course, now the can, as it's hit the edge of that thing, has a nice disorderly dent in the edge. He takes the can, he throws it on the sidewalk, and it promptly bounces out in the street. Of course, it's got a new dent being thrown on the sidewalk, but in the street, he wants to put it back on the sidewalk, so he gives it a good kick in the side, and it's got three more dents. Now the lid happens to be lying there on the ground, and the man in the truck gets his opportunity. He backs over the lid carefully, and then to make sure that he's done the job properly, he drives over it once more. And now the lid forever after goes like this on top of the can. That's how a garbage can is treated. I know men who treat their wives that way. You, sir, are to treat your wife like a fragile vessel, like a fragile vase. Ming Dynasty. I think that takes care of our counseling session for tonight, sir. You go home and you start doing these things, and you're going to see a lot of things happen. Next week, ma'am, we'll talk about you and your responsibilities. But I think so long as we have talked where we should about you as the one who assumes the responsibilities in the home and thereby assumes the headship in the home, if we have gotten you off to a good start, sir, the rest is going to come swimmingly. Let's pray.